This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, good evening. This is our third session of our mini medical school in winning the war on women's cancer with a focus on gynecologic oncology. Has everybody been here for all the sessions so far? Anybody who's missed one? The first session we did was the introduction, and we gave you guys some homework. Did they talk about the homework last week? Yep. Did your reading? So if I say to you, what do we do in terms of management of uterine cancer? What's our primary treatment? Do you guys remember? We typically think about surgery as primary treatment for uterine cancer, if possible. And that segues into our discussion this evening, because we're going to talk about different types of surgery that we do for gynecologic cancer. We're going to address laparoscopic surgery, a little bit of robotic surgery, and then spend time talking about surgery for ovarian cancer. My co-speaker this evening is Dr. Stephanie Ueda, and ironically, she's in surgery right now, and will be joining me when she gets finished. So we flipped the order of the topics just a little bit. My original plan was to start with the open surgery, but we'll start with minimally invasive surgery and talk through that. When we talk about surgical advances, certainly as we're able to perform surgery for cancer, the original model was remove all the tumor that you can. And that was true for uterine cancer. We talk about taking out the uterus, which is doing a hysterectomy. In ovarian cancer, we take out the uterus, the ovaries, the tubes, as much tumor as possible, which we call a tumor debulking, and you'll see some more examples of that in just a little bit. And for cervical cancer, we also talk about doing a hysterectomy. Traditionally, that surgery is done through an incision in the abdomen, which obviously requires advances in anesthesia technique. It requires the ability to get good pain control, and it requires the ability to heal and recover from a surgery. As surgery has become more advanced, we've relied on more technology, such that laparoscopy was developed several decades ago, where we are able to place a fiber optic camera into the abdomen to be able to see, and we can do this surgery through small incisions, which I'll show you kind of what is featured through that. And more recently, you know, as technology has been even more advanced, has anybody heard of the Da Vinci robot? Has anybody seen a Da Vinci robot? How about on TV? They had one on Grey's Anatomy once, where they gave the chief surgeon a Da Vinci robot and convinced her that she should really stay at the hospital to stay on their faculty. We don't have that type of enticement here, but we do have the robotic system, which I'll talk a little bit about because people come and say, can I have my surgery robotically? And you know, part of what we want to discuss is why we do surgery in the way that we do it, and also you know, how that technology is helpful, but where we maybe don't need to use it all the time because there are costs and there are some risks associated. So minimally invasive surgery means surgery that's performed through small incisions. Recall when we talked about anatomy, we discussed the abdomen, and the pelvic organs are in the pelvis, which is kind of in the lower aspect of the abdomen. So gynecologic surgery is actually pretty well set up for us to be able to think about minimally invasive surgery because we can make small incisions, we can look and see the pelvis, and we also can make an incision in the vagina, of all things, and be able to take out the uterus through the vagina. The reason we think about minimally invasive surgery is that as opposed to a large abdominal incision, people can recover faster because the incisions are smaller. There's less discomfort, less infection, less scarring, and overall less blood loss. So we really do really have a desire to try and do surgery as minimally invasively as possible. you'll hear people talk about different types of minimal invasive surgery. Vaginal surgery is minimally invasive surgery. You know, there's a joke they tell in medicine about, you know, the people who can fix a car. I don't know if people have heard this joke. I actually can't tell this joke. There's the orthopedic surgeon who, you know, fixes a car using a carburetor and a monkey wrench. But the gynecologist comes along and says, well, I can do all of that, but I can do it through a keyhole. And when we do vaginal surgery, we're actually doing it through a keyhole, so to speak, because the vagina has an opening, and depending on how big that opening is, we can do a certain amount of surgery there to take the uterus out through the vagina. The laparoscopy is where we add the camera, looking in from above, and the robotic assisted is really just a specialized form of laparoscopy where we use the Da Vinci robot. I'll show you kind of the advantages that it has, but really it's just an extra tool that we use to do surgery. People may have heard of the term of NOTES, or natural orifice transluminal endoscopic surgery. Has anybody heard of that? They talk about taking out your appendix through your esophagus, or they talk about using access to the abdomen through, usually it's part of the bowel where they make a small incision and do this transluminal surgery. It's not something done very often. It's not something that we really recommend because from an infection standpoint, we can do laparoscopic surgery easily enough, and it's not really something that we would consider for a gynecologic surgery. Single incision laparoscopy, on the other hand, is something that some gynecologic surgeons will offer, and that's where we make a slightly larger incision, and we put in what's called a port, and that port allows us to be able to place a few instruments into that port to be able to operate through one incision by the time we finish. And some people find that is cosmetically a more acceptable surgery. And again, it's a matter of, do you make 1 3-centimeter incision in the belly button, or do you make 3 1-centimeter incisions across the abdomen? There's different kind of feelings about that. We typically will think about doing a laparoscopy. And when we talk about straight stick laparoscopy, it has to do with the instrumentation that we use to reach the pelvis. So a vaginal hysterectomy is when a woman goes to the gynecologist and has a pelvic exam. We place the speculum in the vagina. We can see the cervix, and this is a view that we're looking at by placing a speculum in the vagina. This is the cervix that we're seeing here, and we're grasping it with an instrument that under anesthesia allows us to pull on the uterus, and frequently when a woman has had children before, there's a little bit of relaxation to the pelvis. So we can pull on the uterus, bring it down, and be able to access it through the vagina. What we're looking at here with this little dotted line is where we would make an incision then in the vagina to be able to get access to the cervix, and then eventually the blood supply to the uterus, and then the uterus itself that we can then deliver through the vagina. We can sometimes take out the ovaries and tubes this way as well, and we frequently combine it with laparoscopy. So a laparoscopic assisted hysterectomy is my go-to procedure, for treating a woman with endometrial cancer, as long as the uterus isn't too big. You can imagine that, you know, if you can fit a baby's head through the vagina, you can fit a uterus that has some reasonable size, but if the uterus is quite large, that's not coming through. We're not going to be able to necessarily do a minimally invasive surgery for that patient. When we do laparoscopy, the instrumentation that we use are long instruments that then reach into the abdomen. What laparoscopy involves is placing a camera into the abdominal cavity, and this is the camera here. It's got a light cord on it that's based on fiber optics, and it shines a light into the abdomen. Remember the pictures that Dr. Chapman showed you initially of here's some organs in the pelvis, where's the uterus, where's the bladder? Those were taken laparoscopically. And I'll show you a video at the end of a laparoscopic hysterectomy. But what we can then look at is what we fill the abdomen with carbon dioxide gas. So normally the abdomen's flat, but this abdomen's distended. And we distend the abdominal cavity with carbon dioxide gas to be able to see. We use carbon dioxide because we will use electrocautery, so you don't want to spark with oxygen and have things set fires. That's a very bad thing in the operating room. But then at the other hand, we will use other instruments to be able to work. The thing to recognize about these instruments is that they go in straight. The reason we call them straight stick is that it's a stick that goes in, and it has the ability to usually allow us to grasp, and we can turn. And this is how we usually work to do our surgery. We'll put more than one instrument in, so we'll sometimes have three, maybe four separate incisions in addition to our camera port, and we'll work to detach the blood supply to the ovary. We'll work to fulgurate, burn the blood supply to the uterus. We'll make an incision to be able to do the hysterectomy and then take the uterus out from below. This is kind of what we typically do with laparoscopy. The way we see is that we have a video. So there's a camera that projects to a monitor that we're then looking at in the room. So in a, it is a sterile field. Everyone's gowned and gloved. But what we're looking at is really on a monitor up here as opposed to looking down into the patient directly. Does that make sense? When we look at data for doing laparoscopic surgery, you know, they originally said, well, the standard is doing open surgery. Are you going to be able to do surgery as effectively laparoscopically as you would with an open surgery? And that's some of the studies that really had to get proven. Like I said, for uterine cancer hysterectomy, that's a pretty basic standard surgery that we want to do. So this was a really important study that was conducted a couple of decades ago that was a randomized study, which means that the patients who were on the study agreed to have surgery for uterine cancer, but neither they nor the surgeon got to pick what type of surgery they would have. So these were patients who were consented. So you'd have to do a research study with patients' informed consent where they said, we don't know if laparoscopy is better. The advantage might be laparoscopy is better. You might recover faster. But there's a risk that we might not be able to do the surgery laparoscopically. We have to convert. There might be that we don't get to do the surgery as well laparoscopically. So, you know, we can do this technique, but they had to really prove that taking out the uterus and the lymph nodes, the number of lymph nodes that we took out, that there wasn't any extra signs of spread of the cancer. We really had to look at outcomes for that. And so this was a cooperative group study, and what that means is that at any one hospital, if we take care of 100 women with endometrial cancer patients a year, to accumulate 1,600 patients having laparoscopy, 900 patients with laparotomy, you know, that's going to take us, what, 25 years to do this study. So what we do is we cooperate with other institutions, and for full disclosure, we didn't participate in this study, but I'm giving you the idea of a clinical trial, is that they got multiple institutions to participate. And so by multiple institutions participating, they can get the study done in 10 years and have the outcome that they need to look at. And what they found was that if you randomize a patient for surgery, either doing laparoscopy or open surgery, that it is more or less successful if you pick the right patients. Picking the right patients means that you want to have somebody who doesn't have a really large uterus. That's not a great patient because we have to make an incision to take out the uterus. Picking the right patient means somebody who doesn't have a lot of scar tissue. So if you have a lot of adhesions, we're not really going to be able to see. That might be a surgery that we do better with in an open surgery. Picking the right patient means that when we do a laparoscopic surgery, we fill the abdomen with carbon dioxide gas. Somebody with lung problems, somebody with heart disease, that might not be the best surgery to pick. And so when we think about picking these patients and how many of these patients had to get converted to an open surgery, a quarter of the patients who had a laparoscopic surgery had to be opened. And the majority of those were because people couldn't see very well. I'll tell you that in this day and age, that percentage of conversion to open is much lower, partly because we can pick patients well for laparoscopic surgery, so that we now, you know, try and really pick the right patients so that we don't have to convert the patients unexpectedly partway through the case. We also have better technology and better techniques. So I'll show you with the Da Vinci robot things that we can do laparoscopically that with, you know, our initial forays into laparoscopy, developing the technique, you know, I think that there still is a learning curve even for the specialty of what things we can do and how we can do it well. The patients who had laparoscopy had shorter lengths of stay, meaning they stayed in the hospital shorter or went home sooner, and they really did have fewer postoperative complications. The surgeons chose to do lymph node dissection less often in these patients, but there was no difference in stage. Do you guys remember what stage means? Right. So if the lymph nodes are positive, that would be a stage 3 uterine cancer. And so one argument would be, well, if you're not taking as many nodes, maybe we're not finding the patients at high-risk disease. But it turns out that they're taking the people that the surgeons were taking enough lymph nodes because the stages were still similar between the two groups. The patients were followed up for an average of about 5 years. And what these little numbers mean in terms of hazard ratio just means, is it equivalent? And what we look at for equivalency is the confidence interval. And when the confidence interval crosses 1, meaning it's 0.9 to 1.46, the number 1 is in between there, it means that it's statistically the same to have a laparoscopic surgery versus an open surgery. The recurrence rates were similar, and the survival for these patients with stage 1 to stage 2 uterine cancer was 90%. So remember, we said uterine cancer patients typically do well. This study and the data that we find supports that and supports that laparoscopy is how we should be addressing these patients. So in fact, nowadays, the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer has one of their standards for a cancer hospital as looking at the number of endometrial cancer patients, uterine cancer patients, undergoing minimally invasive surgery. So you want to have most of your patients undergoing minimally invasive surgery. I would say that probably about 85% of our patients can have laparoscopic surgery for their uterine cancer. And that's a good number that in the past we weren't able to treat with minimally invasive surgery and had more dissection and more morbidity. The next thing I wanted to talk about was sentinel lymph node mapping. So remember, when we do a hysterectomy for uterine cancer, one of the other things that we talk about is assessing the lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are a place that cancer can spread to. Dr. Ueda will show you in her slide set a picture of a woman with lymphedema. Has anyone heard of lymphedema? Does anyone know what that is? Do you want to describe it? And that swelling you can get after taking out lymph nodes in breast cancer surgery, women talk about lymphedema in the arm because the lymph nodes that they take out are in the axilla. In gynecologic cancer surgery, we talk about lymphedema in the lower extremities and up to the pelvis because when you take out the lymph nodes, that lymphatic drainage and the circulation can be affected. We know that cancer can affect it. We know that surgery can affect it. We know that radiation can affect it. And some people are just predisposed to it so that they get lymphedema even though they haven't had all of these issues. But what we also know is that in endometrial cancer, we're trying to advance and think about how we could potentially do a lesser lymph node dissection. And this, for low-risk disease, is accepted. For high-risk disease, we're still trying to understand where the process is, but I wanted to just kind of show you where the technology is going. Where the technology is going in terms of thinking about the lymph nodes is, if you could pick the first lymph node that the cancer drains to, that's called a sentinel lymph node. So a sentinel event, a sentinel lymph node, it doesn't mean that that's where there is cancer. So I think it's important to understand that a sentinel lymph node isn't always positive. It's positive because it's green. We can see it. But it's not necessarily positive because there's cancer in that lymph node. So the importance is recognizing, do we see a sentinel lymph node? And then the second is having the pathologist process that lymph node and tell us whether there's cancer there or not. Where we are right now is that we're developing the technology of identifying a sentinel lymph node. And what we do to do that is that as we're starting the surgery, we take a green fluorescent dye and we inject it into the cervix. So this, again, is a speculum looking into the vagina. This is not as clear as the cartoon, but there's the cervix and there's a needle injecting indocyanine green. It fluoresces. And so under fluorescent lighting, you can see that it shows up as a green lymph node. These two pictures are actually the same picture. And this lymph node is this little guy right here, which looks like a lymph node under normal light, but if you flip on this indocyanine green, what you can see is that the lymphatics have drained there. So we inject the cervix, and we can find a sentinel lymph node. The lymph nodes, where we look for these sentinel lymph nodes is our understanding of where lymph node drainage occurs. So the uterus sits here. And the lymph nodes that are most commonly affected in uterine cancer are either the pelvic nodes or the para-aortic lymph nodes. So aorta, vena cava, aortocaval lymph nodes. The majority of the lymph nodes are going to be in the pelvis. And so when we inject the cervix, we hope to see a bright node in the pelvis, which we would then remove. So here's a picture of laparoscopy. This is the uterus. This is the tubes. And you can see this little channel that's starting to show up here. as we open up the space and we get into, this is the blood vessel, the external iliac artery, the internals here, the ureter's down here, we can see this lymph node. This lymph node is this lymph node right here. It shows up as this, the way that we see it on that other picture that we saw. It shows up as bright green under fluorescence. So if we see a lymph node that's bright, we remove that, and that's our sentinel lymph node. Currently, for patients who have a larger uterine cancer, we're removing the sentinel lymph node, and we're still doing a lymph node dissection because we're still trying to correlate the data that we have from, are we finding a sentinel lymph node each time? So if you inject dye, does something show up as green? If it doesn't show up as green, you haven't found a sentinel lymph node, so we'll do a lymph node dissection. Right now, for low-risk disease, if we have a sentinel lymph node, we could potentially stop. Low-risk disease means a grade 1 cancer, small cancer, not invasive cancer. Potentially that we can stop with doing a sentinel node dissection if we don't need to take out a lot of lymph nodes. For a high-risk cancer, we would probably find the sentinel lymph node, but then still remove additional lymph nodes as we're trying to understand how effective sentinel lymph node identification is. So if we think about a sentinel lymph node, if you find it and it's a true positive, then that sentinel node will be positive before the other nodes are positive. If you take a sentinel lymph node out and you call it a sentinel lymph node, but you take out other lymph nodes and that lymph node's positive but the sentinel lymph node's negative, then you've missed finding the actual sentinel lymph node. What you found was a false positive. And until we're comfortable with our true positive and our false positive rates, we in this institution are still working on implementing sentinel lymph node mapping for more advanced disease.
So you do that before you do the surgery?
We do that before we do the hysterectomy. Of course, it's part of the surgery. But we do that before we take out the uterus. So the first thing we do is we inject the cervix. Within 20 to 30 minutes, we want to look for that node. When we see the node, we want to remove it. And then after we remove it, if it looks suspicious, we'll do a frozen section. And if it doesn't look suspicious, we'll continue with the hysterectomy and do the rest of our surgery. That's right. Other questions? No. Okay. The robot we talked about a little bit of some people have seen, some people have heard about. It's certainly been marketed heavily in terms of being the greatest thing since sliced bread because you can slice bread with it. You could probably, butter bread with it. And people have shown videos where you can do origami animals and throw paper airplanes with it. However, it is a good tool, and it is helpful for doing some really deep pelvic surgery that you can benefit from having visualization. So one of the things about the robotic platform is that, first of all, it's in 3D. And I can't show that to you here, but what you can appreciate is that the camera actually has two cameras in it, so you actually have binocular vision as the surgeon is sitting down at the console looking into what the picture looks like. The second key thing about the robot, and I have no financial interest, but the second thing that the robot can do, remember we talked about with a straight stick, you can insert the instrument, and you can open and close, and you can turn. The robot has an extra 2 degrees of freedom where you actually can turn your wrist. If you think about your hand as only being able to do this or this, there's only certain things that you can do. But when you can start doing this maneuver, especially when we're operating in the pelvis, remember that pelvis that has kind of a deep space that's pretty small, we can start doing more complicated surgery down deep in the pelvis. Yeah. You can't spin round and round because your hand still controls the instrument. So my hand is still controlling the wristed action. So no, without my hand going around, it doesn't. And you can't because the device is set up so that it's on a pulley system that it's not free spinning. But I think you could design one that does that. But because it's still a surgeon controlled robot, it's not an automated robot. It's a surgeon controlled robot. So you still want to follow the natural motions of your hand. The third thing that the robot does, so binocular vision, wristed technology, and the third thing is that it actually holds the camera steady better than I can because the robot is a machine where it's holding things steady. It's holding, there's an accessory port where you can lift things up. It's pretty strong because, again, it's a machine. And in a patient where we're trying to elevate targets that we're trying to move, if we're trying to kind of lift up on the abdominal wall, the robot's very helpful to be able to help us do that. So it really is an important technology that we have. It's not the greatest thing since sliced bread, but it allows us to do more surgery that we weren't able to do before we had this technology. You can be a little finer than you can be because you don't have a tremor, and you can be finer because you can see so much better than you could even with just your eyes, especially my eyes now that I'm age 42. Everything kind of went downhill. But if you can actually see much better because of this visualization on the laparoscopy. So there are some advantages to this to the machine helping you. The robot is the robot costs, meaning that the system costs money to implement. The tools that you use are not reusable beyond a certain number of times, so you kind of have to replenish your instruments continuously. And so there's an argument about, is there a cost and is it worth it? And worth is always a challenge when we are in medicine because we're having a discussion about, what is worth a day in the hospital? What is worth recovering and getting back to your job sooner? What is worth not having to take extra time off to take care of your kids? So I think that those things are all important, but they've compared robotic with laparoscopic surgery. There's been studies that have compared robotic with open surgery. And overall, the conclusion is that robotic surgery compared to even laparoscopic, there's lower blood loss. There's fewer conversions to open surgery. Remember I was showing you in the laparoscopic series, it was about 25%. And sometimes that's because in a patient who's very obese and has a lot of extra fatty tissue, it's really hard to see. We can get better visualization, and we can frequently do a better dissection in the deep pelvis with the robotic platform. There are some complications because we use cautery, but the operating time, lymph length of stay, lymph node numbers, the surgical outcomes are pretty similar. So that if surgeons have a choice of a robotic platform, many times they will choose it for the right patients, meaning the patients that really you have the robot to help be an advantage for you. Comparing it with open surgery, robotic surgery certainly has less blood loss, complications, length of stay, but the operating time is longer for a robotic surgery than for an open surgery. So there's a cost of anesthesia and being in the operating room, but on balance of things, we think that minimally invasive surgery is important and robotic surgery is an important technology that we include. Okay, I'm going to show you guys a video that's only a minute long, if I can figure out how to do this. Just a second. Da Vinci is, again, this is not my video, but I wanted to show you kind of what it looks like. So the surgeon sits at a console. The console you can kind of ergonomically set up. They're looking through it. And then these are the arms. So when they talk about the arms, there's a camera and there's instruments that go down that we can feed to be able to do the surgery. The instruments go in through a laparoscopic port. It's showing the kind of the wristed technology of being able to move. And these are the different types of instruments that we can use. The surgeon will see in 3D, so you can see with binocular vision what they're able to work on. And these are the hand controls that I was talking about. So when you're putting your fingers in, you're operating kind of, you're still doing the operating. It's never a remote control operation. But this is an example of with one hand, the surgeon's holding up, and with the other hand, they're using the instruments. You can see their motion that they're using to turn their wrist and put the suture in. There's a cart that has the video. And at a teaching institution, we have two consoles. So we have an assistant, our resident, our fellow, who sits at the one console while we're at the other one working. And so we're able to still do a supervised surgery and be able to teach our learners how to do this surgery as well. UCSF has one XI system here at Parnassus, and we have three robots over at Mission Bay. They're used by the urology service, the gynecology service, the gyn-onc service, the colorectal service, and the head and neck service. The question is, if you're having a robotic surgery, is it still considered a major surgery? I would say so. It's minimally invasive, but it's still a major operation in that you're having a general anesthetic, you're under anesthesia for a while, we're taking out the uterus, we're taking out lymph nodes. I mean, that's a cancer surgery that we would typically make with an incision. And so, no, I do think that it's a major surgery, but we hope that people can have a quick recovery from this major surgery. Yeah, so the question is ultrasound surgery, laser surgery versus scalpel surgery. So on the skin, we typically still make our incision, you know, with a skin knife, a scalpel. But we have a lot of other instruments that we use during the surgery, including electrocautery. So that's electricity that we use to help cauterize tissue. That's probably the most common energy source that we use. But we do use ultrasound. There's a device called the harmonic scalpel that's used by that's used by sonic waves that are desiccating the tissue by vibrating. Laser is used to ablate or burn or fulgurate tissue. But most of the time we use electrocautery, both for open surgery as well as for laparoscopic or minimally invasive surgery. Your timing is actually perfect, impeccable as always, Dr. Ueda. I wanted to introduce my colleague, Dr. Stephanie Ueda, because I did an introduction and we talked about laparoscopic, vaginal laparoscopic robotic surgery. Okay. And so we're going to do open surgery. And then at the very end, I have a 10-minute video on laparoscopic hysterectomy if we have time. And if not, I'll send you guys the link so you can watch it in your own time. Pointer here.
Okay. Then... Great. So I know Dr. Chen and some of you may have been here for the mini medical school. Was it last week or 2 weeks
ago? I think they did genetics the week before they did
an egg. So I was told this is kind of an interactive session. So I tried to leave mostly photos and to keep it kind of open so that if you guys had questions about surgery, either things that you've seen, heard, or wanted more input on, I could also kind of talk about that. So how do we decide who should go to surgery and who shouldn't? It's a number of factors. We look at what we call performance status, and a way to know that is not only just seeing the patient and knowing what they look like. You can sometimes tell by how advanced the cancer is, their overall nutritional status. We can look at labs. But there are some actual models or ways for us to sort of dictate whether they're functionally capable or have a higher risk of complications from undergoing a major surgery. So why I'm a little bit mildly late today is I just finished an ovarian cancer surgery. And you always have to weigh the extent of the disease, the patient's performance status, and then, of course, do the counseling to see if they're up for what could be a very long and big surgery with a long recovery. One of those ways to sort of measure how complex or if the patient is able to is something called the ASA, the American Society of Anesthesiologists. So when you had, if you were a loved one has undergone surgery, whether you know it or not, when the anesthesiologist meets you in the pre-op area, we here have something called Prepare Clinic. They're actually doing assessment looking through your medical history. Maybe they've seen you in person. They not only look at your airway and your medical history, they determine your classification. And so a lot of our patients, being a referral center, our patients are ASA class 3 or 4. So I kind of tried to make it very simple. ASA 1 means you're healthy. Most of us here in this room today, if you were undergoing a tonsillectomy, would be a healthy patient. 2 means that you have no real functional limitation, meaning you can go to the store, you're driving a car, you can walk a mile with your friends. 3 or 4, which is what a lot of our patients, meaning they have some limitation functionally, and not surprising, we're cancer physicians, so a lot of our patients that are presenting for surgery are presenting for cancer-based surgery. For ovarian cancer, that can be very advanced, even for some other cervical cancer, so they're a bit more functionally limited. 4 means that they have a severe life-threatening illness, and 5 literally means that they're unlikely to survive 24 hours. So most of our patients are not 5. You're not thinking or you're counseling them very differently. But a lot of our patients that we're taking for surgery for advanced disease are ASA 3 or 4. More recently, what we've been doing as a group, and some of you, if you've had recently been in our clinic or maybe have been one of our patients or have a loved one, is something called the timed up and go test or the tug test. And it's a very simple test, meaning we actually see if patients are able to stand from a chair, walk on a straight line about 10 feet away, and return. And surprisingly, that doesn't sound very difficult, but if you have advanced cancer, maybe you're age 70 years old, you've had hip replacement, some of those things can be more difficult. And what they've seen is that with these patients, the longer it takes, that as actually corresponds with what we call morbidity, meaning complications around the time of surgery. And so the first 30 days is called 30-day morbidity, and the longer the test, particularly if it's over 20 seconds that it takes for you to get up from the chair, walk those 10 feet, and come back, that can be a surrogate marker for how well patients will do. And again, doesn't mean that you're not a surgical candidate, but we factor all that in our counseling. And as a patient, you know, that might be a wake-up call to you to saying that, hey, I'm not able to do the things that I normally could do, and maybe looking at some other options. A lot of patients that come to us want surgery, but whether surgery is the right thing is always part of our decision making. So what do we do for testing? And you might have been doing this before. You know, it varies. Usually it's a blood count, which is your blood level. That's helpful to know what we're starting at. If you have certain types of cancers, you might be bleeding, so you start off at a lower level. Patients sometimes will ask me, their loved ones will ask me, can I donate blood? I tell them I prefer you not to donate your own blood. If patients want to, or their family members want to donate blood to replace blood that might be lost, it's just that the life of a red blood cell or a blood level is 120 days. So if you get blood taken, it takes almost 4 months to replace that blood. So if you start off low, you're not going to get that right away. So you're just going to be taking back the blood that we give. So we recommend not giving your own blood before a surgery, but we welcome patients, family members, or friends that want to donate for them or to the blood bank, because a lot of our surgeries do involve giving blood. Some other things that we may do, not for every patient, but an EKG, those are those little stickers that you get placed along your chest. An echo is where you have an ultrasound of the heart to look at heart function. Those are more for patients who have heart disease, maybe are shorter breath, when they walk stairs. These are all things that we look at. And so these latter lower level testing, we don't do for every patient, but you know, we do look at some of those factors, and our anesthesiologists look at those factors to determine how you will do in the perioperative period. You may have seen this in our clinic, heard about it. It doesn't taste good, I'll be honest, but it's something called impact. And why does that matter? We also know for our patients that nutrition is a huge factor, and it's an unfortunate domino effect. If you're facing or you're diagnosed with an advanced cancer or even a new cancer, you're probably not eating your norm, you're not exercising your norm. So you may be starting off what we call lower functional status. But keeping up nutrition is an important thing for recovery, not only for wound healing. Some of our surgeries involve bowel surgery, so for that bowel surgery to heal, if your nutritional status is lower, those just are factors that work against us in taking a little bit longer to heal. Doesn't mean you're going to have absolute complications, but your risk for infection and wound healing are definitely lower if your nutritional status start off low. One of those things that we measure is called an albumin, and that's a blood test that we do often order a lot of times. And I look at it, especially if I'm thinking of a big surgery for one of my patients, because we know that if the albumin is below 3, and 3 is like the lower end of normal, that those patients have a higher risk for infection or wound complications, as well as bowel surgery complications. Some of these other blood tests we order less well, but these are all blood tests that you can order, and they just are signs that they're lower end of normal. We do give antibiotics for most of our big open surgeries and even for our minimally invasive surgeries. The reason being, if we take out a uterus, that's what we call a clean contaminated surgery. We're entering the vagina. There's bacteria in the vagina, and it's mostly good bacteria. But when you're then dealing with a surgery where you're then cutting into that space, maybe then you do a bowel surgery, and that also has stool. It doesn't mean that you have to be having stool spilled into the wound, but think of all that different bacteria, then your immune system is a little bit compromised. You're trying to heal from a big surgery. All those things together, despite antibiotics, could put you at risk for infection. And this last thing, which is thromboembolic, a big word for clots. So we know clots can form. Women are more at risk. If you're postmenopausal, you're more at risk. Then you've gone through a big surgery and you're less likely to walk and get out of bed. Maybe you're overweight. Those are all factors that factor into it. And we've seen now that these risks for clots can last up to 28 days postoperatively. So if you've had recent surgery with us or at another hospital, you may notice that besides those little massage boots, which we call sequential compression devices, that we're actually doing some other things, something called Lovenox or heparin, which are injectable medications. And we continue that for 28 days because we've seen that decreases the risk of blood clots by about 20%. And it's the blood clots in the legs can be very painful, but if they go to the lungs, they can be deadly. So incisions. These are different types of open incisions. The more classic ones we do are up and down midline incisions. Why? I try to explain it simply to our patients is most of the time we're dealing with a pelvic possible cancer or mass. But if we need to do other biopsies, if we need to explore if it's gone to other places, we really have to be able to evaluate the upper abdomen. Has it spread to something called the omentum, which is sort of like a fatty apron that hangs off the colon? Has it gone to the liver, or at least can we assess that? If we're trying to do it through this bikini cut, which you might have had if you had a C-section or if you know that someone's had a C-section, that can be pretty challenging to be able to see into the upper abdomen. It doesn't mean that we don't do these surgeries. Sometimes we do still for a standard hysterectomy or a radical hysterectomy, but sometimes it just makes visualization more difficult. Also, when we're doing surgery for ovarian masses, unfortunately, unlike a breast mass where we can get a biopsy and know that we have a breast cancer before going in, if we're doing a surgery for an ovarian mass, we don't have that luxury. We can't take a biopsy with a needle and go into the mass, get cells out, and know what it is. The reason being we could be theoretically spreading cancer cells into the rest of the abdomen, as well as to get to the most worrisome part, which usually is like a solid component or something that looks very irregular, is very tricky because you're using a small needle under image guidance to get to that one area. So we want to take this mass out intact because if we rupture it, we could be spreading cells that are cancerous or precancerous. So as you can imagine, the bigger the mass, and if we have higher concern for cancer, the bigger this incision becomes. And if there's upper disease involvement of the upper abdomen, this becomes an incision from here all the way up to your rib cage, because that's the only way to fully explore and know what's going on. And that's where pain control comes into play. Obviously, to take deep breaths postoperatively, if you have this huge incision, becomes more of a problem. So we try to do epidurals a lot. But even with that, having not been through it, I can imagine that it's still very painful for our patients. The reason we have to really work on pain control is then that you don't take deep breaths postoperatively and you can develop pneumonias. So if you've ever had surgery, you might be given this spirometer, which is a big breathing tube to help you breathe deep, take a deep breath in, not so much breathe out. So I'm going to be showing a lot of photos of what we see in surgery. Hopefully this won't gross you out. I assume if you're here, you're a bit curious, and that's why you don't mind. So this is actually the omentum. See what I mean by a fatty apron? I call it like a shag rug, an old 70s shag rug. So this is the colon. The colon is also known as a large bowel. And this hangs off, this particular area here is called the transverse colon. And the colon, I think you've had, some of you were here for the anatomy side of it, is like an upside down U. And where you poop is like the lower or descending colon. This is the midway point. So when I say the omentum, it sort of hangs off the transverse colon, which is right in the middle, sort of in the upper abdomen. And this is a place that ovarian cancer likes. So it's not surprising to us that for patients that we see more advanced disease, that this is actually a normal omentum, fatty, healthy, hanging off the colon. And I have another photo here that shows when it's actually diseased. But this is a site that we have to evaluate either with small incisions, small camera, or actually extending the incision up so that we can see it, especially when we're dealing with a tumor that we're suspecting for ovarian cancer or precancer. So when we go in for a mass, and if we think it's only in that ovary or only in the uterus, we may do what's called biopsies. So uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, those are what we call surgically staged, meaning that we go in usually for surgery first, ideally, not always, so that we can fully assess the extent of the cancer, and we take additional biopsies. So we put fluid into the pelvis, and then we suck up the fluid. Why does that matter? That could show cells in that fluid, and that could increase your stage, might even change whether we give treatment to you postoperatively or not. We'll take biopsies, something called the peritoneum, which I do have here, and I kind of explain the peritoneum is sort of like saran wrap that kind of covers all of your organs on the inside. But again, it's a type of an area where gynecologic cancers like, and they can be really small, almost like throwing confetti or small pieces into the pelvis. It can be hard to see, and unfortunately, imaging doesn't pick that up, no matter how sensitive that it is. Very difficult to see on imaging. We'll sample lymph nodes. Lymph nodes are throughout your body. You might feel them in your neck when you get sick. But the ones you worry about are in the pelvis and higher up called the parotid lymph nodes. Omentum here. And then for some tumors, we actually take out the appendix. The reason being, if we went in for a mass, we take it out, meaning an ovarian mass, even a uterine mass. About 20% of the time, we'll find more disease in these additional biopsies. And then your tumor is no longer stage one. It is now more advanced, even up to stage three. And that definitely matters in what we talk about postoperatively for treatment. So this is a laparoscopic or with a small camera, what it looks like to us. So it has, now we're using robotic surgery, it's very high definition. this is what it looks like open, a little bit different with self-retaining retractors that are holding everything back. So if you've had major surgery with one of us, you might notice when you get out, it feels like you're totally bruised. Maybe you feel like you can't walk right. It's because you're now in these, where you've had these self-retaining retractors kept open so we can see actually into the abdomen and pelvis. But this is what we're seeing. So this is the same view. These are the major vessels going down into the pelvis. This is the same thing on a different patient here. So you can see the different views that we're seeing. And essentially, these are with the lymph nodes already removed. And this is what the lymph nodes will move all along here, above this nerve here, which is called the obturator nerve. And we take about 60% of the lymph nodes out of this space to help stage some of our ovarian and uterine cancer patients. We're trying more and more to get away from a full lymph node dissection if we can, particularly for uterine and cervical cancer. The reason being, if we take out 60% of these lymph nodes here, at least 10% of patients have pretty significant lymphedema or swelling in their legs postoperatively. And if you know someone that's had breast cancer, they used to do full axillary lymph nodes before under the armpit, and then they would have huge swelling in the arms. So we're now trying to do what's called sentinel nodes, where we try to identify the first lymph node where the cancer could spread to, and just removing one or two nodes. For ovarian cancer, that doesn't quite work because of the way ovarian cancer spreads. It spreads more in a clockwise fashion in the abdomen. But for uterine and cervical cancer, we're trying to, for more of our patients, do sentinel nodes. That is a little bit more challenging in open surgery because we don't have the same technology. For minimally invasive surgery, we have fluorescence cameras that allow us to see the dye travel. For open surgery, there are dyes that can be injected, but it's just much, much harder to see, believe it or not, into the rest of the space. Because as you can see here, if you're trying to look for a blue or green dye, pretty difficult sometimes in this space. Yes? I usually explain that 10% of patients have lifelong lymphedema. And it can develop right after surgery. It can develop 3 months. But if you have it by 3 months, it might get a little bit better. But we don't tend to see significant changes. So that means 90% don't have, they might have slight swelling after standing at work all day. But there are 10% of patients where it becomes significant, where they have a harder time walking. You might have to wear compression stockings. We send them for lymph massage. So if we can avoid doing it, we try. So we're trying these things like sentinel node biopsies for certain types of cancer. But for some patients, it's still necessary to do it. Yes? So far, no. We do things like we send patients to lymphedema clinics, which is oftentimes fitting them better for certain stockings. And there's now these other compression devices that we're trying at home. But yeah, if you have it, it can be very significant. So that's why we're trying to get away from not compromising knowing the extent of the cancer and surgically assessing it appropriately versus this 10% that have very significant life changes where they maybe felt that that wasn't necessary. So you did take out 25 nodes and then all of them are negative. We then have fully assessed the cancer. But then if you have the 10% that have significant lymphedema, that is not going to make you feel better 5 years later when you're cancer-free. So we always have to weigh those risks and benefits. So at least for certain types of cancer, we're trying to get away to, and trying to do less invasive things, but still not miss the cancers that have spread, which would dictate or warrant further treatment. So a little bit difficult to see here, but this is actually your appendix hanging off the, this is the right or ascending colon. So this appendix is actually normal, and the appendix is a vestigial organ, meaning you could live without it. The only way you might notice it is if you were younger and had pain in this lower right pelvis, they might think you have appendicitis. The only reason I bring it up is certain types of our tumors, particularly mucinous types of ovarian tumors, scan spread to the appendix. So we do sometimes remove it, even if it looks normal for staging, but it is a place that can be involved with tumor. And then seeing here, these are really small, but see this little pink strip of what I call saran wrap? That's peritoneum. And it's lining this whole pelvis here. And it's kind of blocked away. This is the lower colon here. So this person here is usually, this surgeon here is just taking a biopsy of that peritoneum. And that allows us to look for microscopic cancer. So we're doing little biopsies, both lymph node, omentum, sometimes appendix. And this is for what we think is a only in the ovary or only sometimes in the uterus cancer. But 20% of the time we might find more disease microscopically. And no scan might show that. And these are what the tumors might actually look like. So this is a borderline tumor, which I kind of equate to as a precancerous tumor. Well, that's not completely correct, but that's the easiest way to kind of describe it. But you can see it looks pretty ugly. This tissue here is like a normal cyst of an ovary, but see how it has these little nodular areas? So these are both borderline tumors. This is what you might see in a minimally invasive high-definition camera, and this is what a gross photo will look once we get it out. yep, this is an ovarian tumor. This is also ovary. But both look abnormal, right? So a postmenopausal ovary should be 1 by 2 by 3 centimeters, so like the size of a walnut. So this is kind of magnified, but this is probably like a 6 centimeter tumor, and this is more like probably like a 9 to 10 centimeter tumor. But see how it has this very solid and ugly component here? So this would already make you start thinking, when if I were to see this, that this is at least a borderline or low-grade cancer, but we send this off for what's called a frozen section, which I have a slide for, and we then have them assess, and they'll probably would take a piece off of this and really look at it, and that's what we're waiting for with a frozen section pathology. Whereas this still looks abnormal, means it doesn't, this could be cysts with fluid, but see how this has some nodularity on the outside? So if we were to have gotten an ultrasound before that, this might say that it has some excrescences or nodularity on this ovary with the ovarian cystic mass that's about, you know, 6 centimeters. Yes. So what we do here is that we do, so there's obviously times where I have a high suspicion and I might do some, like if I think it's a mucinous tumor, take out the appendix. You can live without the appendix. I generally wait to do the lymph node dissection until I have the frozen because, I, like I said, the 10% of time. But the frozen section takes about 30 minutes. So say we're doing the hysterectomy while taking out the ovarian mass. We can usually do that while we're waiting for the frozen section. Other patients very strongly or if they desire future fertility because they're younger, yes, we're going to wait. We're literally sitting down in the OR waiting for 30 minutes or so to get our frozen section because we're not going to want to make additional things without knowing what we need to do. Most of my patients that are postmenopausal, if I'm going in, they're like, take out whatever you see. So it might be taking out the other ovary and tube that looks normal. It might be doing the hysterectomy while we, so we're continuing on while we're waiting for the frozen. But there are other patients that clearly want to save or preserve things until we have the frozen. But the frozen section, generally about 30 minutes in the ideal situation. Sometimes if it's a more challenging case, it can be an hour. So yes, you're under anesthesia maybe for an hour longer, but it's better than coming in for a second surgery and getting reintubated. If you didn't have that luxury, or you might have gotten surgery at an outside community hospital, if they don't have pathologists who can do frozen sections, you might be seeing me after they then, on final pathology, get something else. And frozen and final don't always correlate, but we try to send it to our pathologist and get a frozen section. And I usually talk about with my patients, depending on that frozen section, what we call it, quick look, then we make decisions of what to do next. And that's because when we do these things, again, we can upstage them or find more things on the patients on the final pathology, on the pathology. And I just wanted to show you some photos, but if you saw some of your imaging, this is a CT scan. And so this has both cystic and solid components, and clearly this ovary is not a walnut, right? And this is what it might look like when you take it out. So we don't open it up on the table usually, but when they open up the pathologist outside of you, so we're not spilling cells ideally, they can then freeze an area. They might take some of this here and take a small shaving of it and look at a microscope, and within about 30 minutes or so tell us what it is to the best. And then we make decisions or further treatment plans based on that. So there's a lot of possibilities on our surgical consent. Yes?
I assume the freezing is just so you can slice it thin?
Yes. And I think I have, so this is what it might look like. This is not all ovaries, but I wanted to show you the process. So we'll take a mass out, and for instance, that mass was taken out. They'll look for the worst part, and they make some fine shavings into that worst part, so not the whole tumor. And then they'll usually be able to fix it and look at it within about 30 minutes. So when we're getting final path, they're then cutting the rest of that specimen over the next couple weeks into many fine slices and doing some extra stains. So you can find more or see more on that, but we need a quick decision so that we can make decisions about next steps for our patients. That's called a frozen section. Hysterectomy. So not again, we do this more for our uterine cancer patients, cervical, although different types, and then some of our ovary if they're done with childbearing. Simple just means that we take everything close to where the uterus is and we don't take any extra vagina. And radical, which we might do for more extensive tumor or cervical cancer, we have to get a wider margin because it can spread by direct tissue spread next. So we're actually getting extra tissue, which is called parametria, and extra vagina to be able to get clearer margins for our tumor. And by doing that, it's a little bit more complex surgery, number one. And number two, we're disrupting more of the nerves to the uterus, so it can have more problems with constipation, urinary issues, you might have had your catheter in for a bit longer because you know that you can't pee right away if we took it out within 6 hours. Whereas our more standard hysterectomies, simple hysterectomies, we can take it out within 6 to 12 hours and patients are usually able to urinate, pee without any issues. Implications of hysterectomy. People always, sometimes some of my patients think, how is that going to affect my sexual function? And studies are sort of mixed. We usually think it does not, by taking out the cervix, affect function, but patients do describe decreasing sexual function or desire after that. And with the ovaries, if they're taken out, that can mean the patient's now in menopause or worsening menopause. Even if we don't take the ovaries out, but we're doing the hysterectomy, we leave it in, sometimes that disruption of the ovarian while we do the surgery can cause an increase in menopausal symptoms. And then even though we do our best to try to, you know, close the vaginal cuff, support the tissue, that tissue's never the same. And if you've had babies before, that whole pelvic floor can be, I call it like a hammock. So those pelvic floor, those muscles kind of weaken over time. Then we do surgery and it kind of compromises it. So that pelvic muscle or floor, that hammock is now weaker. So more incontinence, more issues with bowel movements can occur after surgery. Not so much weight, but what we see with that is those patients also sometimes have other what we call comorbidities like diabetes and so forth, but not necessarily weight by itself is an issue. So ovarian cancer. So I talked a little bit about if it's early stage, meaning we have an ovarian mass, we're taking a patient in, we only think it's in the ovary, and then we do those additional biopsies, for instance, or we think it's only in the uterus, we do those additional biopsies. What if we have a better idea at the beginning or when you're seeing me that this is more likely advanced cancer? And this is what it might look like. So that same peritoneum, remember that pink sheen, that pink saran wrap that I just showed a biopsy of? This is the same thing. This is peritoneum, not studded with tumor. This is not the same as that peritoneum that you saw in that other pelvis. So this is now all disease that's all studded the peritoneum, and we see that with advanced ovarian cancer. And if we look at a CT scan, this is the same omentum. It should look fatty and very, very the same, homogeneous looking. This one is very, very thickened here, right over the colon, which is here. And this is all fluid around that omentum, which we call ascites. So sometimes we can tell on a CT, but if we're seeing on a CT, it means it's already pretty extensive. And we can't always see all the extent of your peritoneal disease or your omental disease, or if we have little dots of tumor studying the bowel, we're not going to be able to see that. So it's always a discussion for ovarian cancer or any advanced cancer. If we already have this information, should we do surgery? So it's not only whether they are healthy enough and whether we can withstand it. It's also what will it take to the best of our knowledge for the surgery to be successful? Because we always want to get, besides just assessing the cancer, we actually want to get to very minimal to no tumor. So we call maximum cytoreduction or tumor cytoreduction. It used to be we tried to get to a less than a centimeter of visible disease. Now we know for every millimeter of disease that we get down to, that the goal should actually be no visible disease, because that doesn't get everything microscopic, but no visible disease has superior outcomes than less than a centimeter. So when we're talking about surgery for these patients, we really want to get down to no visible disease. And if we think we're unlikely to do that, or if the patient cannot withstand what it would take surgically to do that, that's when you're looking at other treatment options up front, maybe not surgery up front. Yes? So the thing about ovarian cancer is it can coat the peritoneum, and that looks pretty bad, right? But we can actually sometimes strip that off. So that's all along the bladder. The bladder is underneath that. So we can sometimes strip that whole peritoneum off the bladder without actually compromising the bladder. So ovarian cancer doesn't always infiltrate into organs. It can. Sometimes it just is on the surface. And so even that surface looked really ugly and bad, sometimes we're able just to strip that off. Of course, that takes time. So to strip that all off can be like a 6 to 9 hour surgery, even though we're not taking out an organ per se, we're just taking out all that disease. Yes, so debulking, tumor cytoreduction, surgical resection, they're synonymous in ovarian cancer. And the goal now is to get down to no visible disease. But technically optimal in the literature, which shows improved outcomes, especially in American or Canadian data, you know, where you have bigger institutions, getting down to less than a centimeter optimal cytoreduction or tumor debulking has been shown to have improved outcomes in both advanced uterine and advanced ovarian cancer. But if we leave more than a centimeter of visible tumor, then it's considered suboptimal, and that's not as good doesn't mean that it doesn't occur for various reasons, but when usually we're talking to patients is with the goal to get down to no visible or a minimum less than a centimeter of disease. The reason being, for ovarian cancer or even advanced uterine cancer, ideally you want to either do the goal of surgery first, but many for our ovarian cancer patients, it also involves chemotherapy, usually with platinum and Taxol or taxane therapy. So the order really depends on all those things we talked about: performance status, patient willingness, what it will take to undergo that surgery, and do we think we can do it, okay? And if the patient's not up for it, or if it would involve two bowel resections, or I just took out someone's spleen, I mean, that may not be every for every patient to be undergo a 6 to 9 hour surgery to do that. I mean, sometimes ICU, blood transfusion, 7-plus-day hospital stay, a lot of family help, maybe even going to a transitional facility. So that's a long recovery that's part of your discussion to talk about with the patient. The reason being, why do we think tumor debulking or cytoreduction is actually helpful? It's because we think by reducing the tumor mass that actually chemotherapy will be more effective in perfusing the tumor. We also think that we might need less or shorter exposure to chemotherapy, so there's less development of drug resistance, and it's the platinum resistance over time, resistance or upfront chemotherapies that become the challenge. And then maybe it sort of enhances your own immune system. Immunotherapy is becoming a very big hot topic, so these are the ideas behind why we think tumor cytoreduction is actually helpful. But we know that if we can't get down to very minimal tumor, then it's not that helpful. Not to mention that to not get down to minimal tumor and then have gone through this big surgery with long recovery, that's just delaying ultimately the second part of the treatment, which is chemotherapy. Yes. Yes, so the other option is starting with chemotherapy first, which I think I have some slides about, but it's called neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So either for your patient that's maybe too ill, or you talk about doing a 9-hour surgery with a bowel resection, they don't want that, or you get into bleeding and you don't think you can do that, then you can start with chemotherapy potentially first. And the idea being is that will shrink the tumor, and then you still do an interval surgery, an interval cytoreduction, if you will, to get the rest of the disease out. But the idea is that chemotherapy still has compromise on the immune system, your blood counts, and so forth. But if they're not going to be able to withstand or they don't want to, then that's the other option. Start with chemo first, do interval surgery, and then usually do more chemotherapy after. So it's either upfront surgery with chemotherapy after, or getting a biopsy to confirm what we have and then doing surgery and then more chemotherapy afterwards. And so this is just to show that, there's a number of institutions, mostly in the U.S., that you can see here that the more you get down to less disease, the survival is actually better. So no gross means no visible, and they've had survival that are improved. These are all multi-institutional or single-site institutions with large data, but this is what we have been justifying for, still considering surgery. It's not for everyone, but considering surgery with the goal to get down to no visible disease. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy, I throw this in because it is a way that we give chemotherapy for some of our ovarian cancer patients, not for our uterine or cervical, and it's different in that you're actually giving chemotherapy right into the whole abdominal cavity. And we do it in patients that have had upfront surgery, who have gotten optimal tumor cytoreduction, so we've gotten down to less than a centimeter, with generally anywhere from stage 2 to stage 4 ovarian cancer. And then we try to put the port in at the same surgery, either up in the upper quadrant or sometimes I'll put it down here. This is what the port might look like. The nurses access it through the skin into the port, and then the chemotherapy goes right into the abdomen. The idea being it sort of mimics how cells spread in the abdomen in this clockwise fashion. While it potentially has some survival benefit, it also has more toxicity. And this is only for ovarian cancer. And so I have some photos here of what it looks like to have advanced disease. So remember that shag rug that looked just fatty? This is now omental caking, omental tumor all along this. But here's our transverse colon here, and the bowel's a little bit dilated. This is a small bowel. This is a patient with significant ascites. That's the fluid building up in the abdomen. And she has a little bit of an umbilical hernia, maybe even tumor here. This is liver disease. So the liver should look more like this red section here, but you can actually have tumor implants. And it's whether, if we're talking about liver resection for a patient, it's how much of the liver can we take out and is it possible? And that's, again, another added morbidity or complexity to the patient here. And so here's the liver here, and this is the diaphragm or peritoneum here. So here's some of that same saran wrap But now we're talking about the saran wrap in the upper abdomen, and we're literally stripping off the muscle, the diaphragm muscle here. And usually we see tend to see more disease in the right upper quadrant because of the way, again, ovarian cancer cells spread in the abdomen. They spread more into the right side up first. So when we're doing these big procedures, or if you've had a loved one undergo it, it's because we're having to dissect all this disease out with the goal to get down to very, very minimal disease. And this is just to show that this doesn't happen all the time. I mean, we're talking about patients who are diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer. It happens maybe in total about 20% of the time. But in the 20% of patients, you need to be at a center where either you have a group of surgeons that can do it, a good anesthesia anesthesiologist who knows how to resuscitate, do fluids, and probably an ICU and blood bank. Otherwise, these are not surgeries you can do regularly at some smaller hospital just because of the extent of it. And this is how subtle it can be. We're not going to pick this up on a CT scan. But this is a mesenteric. The mesenteric is the blood supply to the, this is the small bowel. And you can see, like, when we're doing exploration, we're literally looking for these little implants because every implant that we don't resect or laser is potentially compromising survival. So we will actually go through this whole site and laser, resect. It's a tedious kind of task. But this is not something you're going to see in a CT scan. But if I saw omental cake, would I be shocked if I saw these little implants here, these little nodules? No, I wouldn't. But this is what we're going for when we're doing tumor center reduction. And so what happens if we do intestinal surgery? So a lot of times, because it starts in the pelvis, we're talking about doing a lot of times lower colon or descending colon, and we use either staples. So this is a stapler going in. So thankfully, no one's awake when we're doing this. But as you can imagine, these are some of the staplers I just wanted to show you that are required to do these kind of surgeries. In some cases, if we think that it will not heal well, or maybe the patient is obstructed from tumor and we can't resect it, we may end up having to do what's called an ostomy. And so this is actually small bowel. It sometimes is permanent, sometimes is temporary, but this is when you bring bowel, healthier bowel, to the surface of the skin. So instead of having all the bowel connected and pooping as you would normally, you're taking healthier bowel higher up in the system and bringing it to the skin, either because you don't think whatever you did below that is healthy and can heal, or because there's tumor obstructing it, and so you're just trying to avoid that area with tumor altogether. So we do it both for palliation as well as if we think that area is not going to heal well. Yes. So sometimes we'll do it for someone that has persistent or recurrent disease, and maybe we're going to offer them chemo or radiation, but we don't think surgically we can get all the tumor out, but they're in pain, or we're worried that the tumor will cause infection, or it'll break down. So then you want to divert everything above it so that they can actually still undergo treatment or have better improved symptoms. So it doesn't get them into remission or get the result you want, but you want to still help them in some way. So can you imagine if we do all these extensive surgeries, there are complications. You can have breakdown of where you just put all the bowel back together. You can have wound complications. A lot of our patients require blood. Ileus is when the bowel, so after we do this kind of 6 to 9 hour surgery, even 3 hour surgery, we're manipulating the bowel, pushing away so we can see and into the pelvis. The bowel can get very inflamed, very swollen. And when it does, it's called peristalsis, where the bowel should normally sort of be moving like this. But when it's swollen, it might move like this. So that you might notice it because you'll be very distended, feel gassy, feel nauseated, and things are not just going through your gastrointestinal tract well because it's very swollen. So there's nothing we can do necessarily. We can give you stool stoppers, we can give you nausea medications, but we just have to wait for that swelling and inflammation to go down with time, hopefully, so that it can start moving again. Sometimes it's due to adhesions. You have to also hope that that swelling decreases down so it can sort of wiggle out of the adhesions. But ileus, which is not a full obstruction, but just the bowel being slow in its movements, happens a lot, 40% of the time. And so these are just pictures of what could happen, which may have happened to you or someone that's had surgery before, but this is a wound infection. So you see how very red and beefy it is. This is a DVT, how the leg is very swollen. So these are things that we're trying to minimize by giving antibiotics before making our first incision. We give prolonged low-dose blood thinner to try to decrease the risk of blood clots. If the ureter, which is the tube that connects the kidneys to the bladder, is at all compromised in any way during surgery because it's close to where we work, we'll sometimes put these stents in to keep the ureter healthy or open. Sometimes we'll even make a repair. We'll leave that in to heal. And then this is just a picture to show, even when you put staple lines or bring things together, that it can break down. And that can be a surgical emergency, because if you're leaking from your bowel, then you need to be re-explored sometimes. So surgery, while has risk for complications, not surprising, the more you do, the more risk there is, and longer the recovery, which is why we're considering neoadjuvant chemo for therapy. So it's not, big surgery like that is not for every patient. It's a discussion of what it might involve and what it might take to be able to get down to that no visible disease. The other option would be neoadjuvant chemotherapy, getting that biopsy where you would try to shrink the tumor down initially to do a, then an interval surgery, which might be less morbid, less complex, less complicated. And there is some data to show that that might be as good as upfront surgery. The largest trial was done in Europe and probably will never be replicated here in the U.S. because people feel pretty strongly one way or the other about which to choose, as do patients. But it did show that when you give upfront chemotherapy with platinum and Taxol versus someone that undergoes surgery first and then gets platinum and Taxol afterwards, that survival was about the same. The critics of this study, which was primarily done at European cancer centers, was that their overall survival was a lot lower than those studies I quoted from big institutions here in the U.S. and Canada. So there is some thought that perhaps some of those centers did not do the optimal tumor bulking or the complex upper abdominal surgery that we do at certain some centers here. But if either don't, again, have that capability, or the patient's not up for it, or we don't think we can do it safely, then I think neoadjuvant chemotherapy can be a very reasonable option to consider. So we do look at a number of factors. Age is one of them, but not the only criteria. I've operated on much older patients than 60. C125, which is a tumor marker that we look for treatment response, is elevated about 80% of ovarian cancers. If it's elevated, the higher it is, yeah, we think there's more disease. But that might also be on a scan. That's what we just use for counseling. We talked about the ASA, which is that American Society of Anesthesiologists score, where the lymph nodes are, where the disease is, how much will it involve. So these are all predictive scores that have not necessarily shown totally that you can't do these surgeries, but there is, the higher the score, the more disease, then there is more risk of not doing the, what the outcome is that you want. And you can even do these surgeries, again, when patients recur. The criteria are different. So when we're doing it for recurrent disease, we really are looking for patients, one, who have good performance status. We think that they're still generally sensitive to our upfront treatments, meaning we can still offer them chemotherapy, potentially. And usually if the tumor has to be sort of isolated or more in a specific spot, so not so diffuse. And so these are the patients that you can offer secondary surgery to, but that's not the same as upfront surgery. So the ideal candidate might be someone like this, who this is a recurrent lymph node right here. And so if they have good performance status and we think it's just isolated disease, it doesn't mean it's still not going to be a complex surgery, but this is the patient you might consider for a second surgery. So the Da Vinci is the robotic system that's been out for the last 10 to 15 years. The benefit is, besides being minimally invasive, it has high-definition optics now, so it's almost like your flat-screen TVs that you see. We can do the sentinel node biopsies because we can see the fluorescent diet that goes between fluorescence camera and the optics you're seeing here. And unlike standard laparoscopy, which is still minimally invasive, it more mimics open-hand surgery, which gives a little bit more capability to do, in my mind, lower pelvis and upper abdominal work. So for some surgeons, it gives them more ability to do either more complex dissections or go from only doing open surgeries or doing open surgeries more often to potentially offering more patients minimally invasive surgery.
So are you saying that that's a robot doing that and not a human?
That's a human who's controlling the instruments. Remember when I showed you on that video, when he moves his hands,
okay,
the instruments are moving. So
there's
a human who's going like this with his fingers, and the machine is responding to what he's doing. And he also has, or she.
Yeah, this robot comes over the patient. We set it up.
Yep,
then we're in a console that we're moving the arms and the camera. But the way we do it is sort of mimics how I would if I was doing open surgery, a lot more than doing it with us holding the camera and the instruments, which is more. This is the blood supply to the ovary that we're taking the vessels. This is an ovary up here, the normal ovary. And you saw the difference between that and that uglier tumor that I had before. So they're... cauterizing electricity and then cutting. So that ovary is now gone, detached, and they're heading toward, eventually toward the uterus. So you see, through the vagina. So you, this right here is a, well, we put a manipulator, which sort of against the cup is a cup that goes against the cervix. So we can push up and mobilize the uterus and feel and see it. And that's a way for us to eventually make a little, what we call colponomy, like along the cervical vaginal junction. And then we have to be able to wiggle it out through a hole about this big. But once it's being decompressed or the blood supply is, you know, not feeding the uterus, a lot of times with anesthesia manipulation, some retraction, you're not awake for it, we are able to wiggle it out through a very small hole. If the uterus is too big, however, that's not a candidate, that's a patient that may not be a candidate for minimally invasive surgery. So when we do it minimally invasive with the ovary, we actually have to put it into a bag, bring it to the surface, and in the bag, either drain it or take it out in pieces without letting any of those cells spill. So we take it out through a bag, not through the vagina. But the hysterectomy, we're going to end up making a hole right here, which is where the cervix and vagina meet. And then that hole ends up being about this big or a little bit like this, and we have to be able to wiggle that uterus out through a hole this big, which we can a lot of times.
So what you're seeing in this video right now is the surgeon is working with a cautery, and the instrument in the right hand is both a cautery and a scissor. So you can see him cutting and cauterizing, or her, I really don't know. And the instrument in the left hand is like a grasper. So they're using it to elevate tissue, and with the other hand, cauterizing and cutting the tissue. We're now on the left side and looking at the very bottom of the screen is the colon. That's the sigmoid colon, the colon that's on the left side. In the middle of the screen is the ovary and the tube. And what the surgeon is doing is separating the ovary from the what we call the sidewall attachments. And then again, identifying the ureter, remember the tube that goes from the kidney down to the bladder, and then creating a window to take the blood supply of the ovary. So they're doing the same thing that they did on the other side on this side now.
And this is the blood. No, that looks normal. This is probably going to be a uterine cancer case, meaning it's in the uterus. And most of our minimally invasive da Vinci surgeries are for uterine cancer because it tends to be, a lot of them present at stage one, and only about 5 to 15% of patients, maybe up to 20%, might have lymph node spread. So we'll do lymph nodes and then take them out as well. But these ovaries and tubes look pretty normal. This is a normal size uterus.
Is that yellow fat?
Yes.
Yes. So they're pushing up on the uterus here with the manipulator, and now they're trying to get toward the blood supply to the uterus called the uterine vessels, which we have to skeletonize to.
You've been referring to as saran wrap, is that?
All this here is peritoneum.
Right.
That on that other picture was all coated with disease. And that we see more with ovarian cancer, peritoneal cancer, fallopian tube cancer. So we'll have to strip all of that off. But as you can see here, we're stripping it off the cervix now. And what we're doing is pushing the bladder off the cervix and vagina. But if it's involved with ovarian tumor, you sometimes have to strip that layer off the bladder to be able to get a disease off.
The saran wrap coats the uterus. It also coats the bladder. And so what the surgeon has done is made an incision in that peritoneum or saran wrap to push the bladder away from the cervix as they're taking the vessels. This is the blood supply to the uterus now coming in from each side. And that's how they're going to be able to free up the uterus all the way down to the vagina.
But yeah, this on the outside all looks visibly normal. This is a normal uterus from what we can tell. And this maybe was done for benign reasons, but usually we're doing it for uterine cancer. So after we get it out, our pathologists open it up and tell us the type of tumor, the size, how invasive it is, and then we determine if we have to do more staging biopsies based on that.
Dr. Weta mentioned a manipulator. So what you can see now is that the surgeon is making an incision behind the cervix into the posterior vagina, and that green cup is sitting around the cervix. And so as the surgeon is cutting down to that cup, that's how they're going to cut all the way around the top of the vagina.
And that cup pushes against the cervix, and we're pushing it up. We move it, we turn over our hand, and it moves it side to side, and that allows us to sort of manipulate.
That's going to be your exit.
Mm-hmm. That's how the uterus is going to leave.
Yep.
This seems really fast.
This is a sped-up video, and it's edited.
Okay. Yeah.
It's in the interest of, we have 10 minutes, so.
So that's our colpotomy, or now our, at the cervical vaginal junction, we made our hole, and then we have to be able to wiggle that uterus out. So if a uterus is too large for whatever reason, then they may not be a candidate for minimally invasive surgery.
So now the uterus is getting delivered out the vagina.
So that cup was inserted
beforehand.
Yeah.
Remember when I showed the picture of injecting the cervix with the dye? We would put the cup in at the same time. Depends on, you know, anywhere from 2 hours to 4 hours, probably.
So just putting a glove into the vagina to, we have to inflate the abdomen with CO2 gas, so this otherwise they would escape through that hole. So, so up here is now bladder kind of being, and has a catheter in it.
And so they are now exchanging instruments. So on the right hand is what we call a needle driver, or something that we can use to grasp and sew with. So not the scissor anymore, but an instrument that they can hold the needle with, and we can now watch them sew and close the vagina. Posteriorly is the rectum, anteriorly is the bladder, and that's why when we talk about surgical injuries or complications, the bowel and the bladder are areas that we would be concerned about.
And these here, our pulsating vessels are where we would do our lymph node dissection. Those are the same vessels, just with tissue over that.
Yeah.
This actually doesn't look as good as what it looks on the screen. It looks even better than
actually
on the screen. It's like watching your current, if you have a recently bought TV, it looks better than this. Yes. So partly why we think, you know, allows us to do this, not only the movement, but the visualization is so much better, that these fine dissections of, you know, taking down the bladder, moving away the ureter, taking a blood supply are easier with that. The optics definitely help.
And if you were doing it open, would you still use the same
be different instruments, but the same motions.
Same motion
of the tissue that we have to come across, the vessels that we have to divide, and the same incision that we have to close. But we use a little bit different instruments because we have our hands and our clamps more directly closer to the tissue. Right. Right. The trick here is that you want to not exchange your instruments a lot.
Mm, they're bleeding a bit.
Yeah, I know. They're bleeding a little bit. It'll stop.
So does it take a lot of time to learn to use this, to make this change?
So for our training, we do 4 years of OBGYN residency, and OBGYNs can do hysterectomies for benign reasons.
Do they learn on that? Do they
now they do.
Students learn?
That is part of the, I mean, because with that, as we have more complex technology, we're constantly having to update.
But one of the interesting things about practicing medicine is that there's constant updates. The genetics that you heard about last week, half of that, most of that wasn't around when we were training. This type of surgery, this Da Vinci robot, wasn't on the market when I was training. But when it comes out, we want to adopt it and look, you know, adopt it with the eye of, you know, some skepticism, looking at evidence. I showed you the evidence of laparoscopic versus open surgery, why we want to do laparoscopic surgery now. Similarly, when there's new tools like the Da Vinci system, we want to use it in a way that we are learning how to use it, figuring out the right place to use it, so that we're not using it indiscriminately, but choosing it as a tool in our toolbox.
How long has this been around?
1995 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Is this type of surgery ever done remotely?
Not yet.
Not yet. That was the original invention, was can you do it military, right? Like you're in Iraq when your surgeon is in New York. But really it turns out that you really have to have that very close bedside assistant, problem solving. And so when they set up Da Vinci systems, they're always that the console and the instruments and the patient are all in the same room.
So is the surgeon still getting feedback from the patient?
There's not tactile feedback, touch, but the visualization, because it's so high of a definition, you can use visual cues a lot more.
And from a surgeon's perspective, how much do you get from the tactile? Is it becoming more like visual acuity rather than...
I think it depends on the surgery. Oops,
mm-hmm.
We're done.
Different types of surgery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you have different tissue response to different types of surgery. So there's certain things that we would do that we'd want to feel the tissue, whereas others we wouldn't.
And I would say there's not no tactile sensation with this compared to it, but you use your visual cues a lot more. I can sort of tell by certain when it's the tissue sort of bouncing off and I'm looking with my eyes, I can sort of say that I'm feeling where that cup is, for instance, even though I'm not touching it with my own finger.
Yeah. So we'll take more questions. I wanted to just include for the video for our homework assignment. I think that Julie last week talked to you all about doing a family tree, getting some information. We're going to talk about that next week as we talk a little bit about identification of risk and screening and prevention. So just to ask to make sure that you follow up on that. And we'll make sure that you get the links for these videos too. So if you want to watch them again, that you can. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll take more questions. Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.